Live from Lane County, Oregon, it's the Bo's Nose Show with your host, West Lane County Commissioner Jay Bolsovich. And now, here's Jay.
Good evening and welcome to the Bo's Nose Show. And it's a nice Thursday evening here in January in Lane County with the usual weather out here. It's raining. So anytime you want to get in and ask a question, you just can call the show. As I say that, I don't have the number in front of me. I'll get it to you in just a second. It is a live show. It's 646-721-9887, and then you just press 1 if you have a question, and our call screener will pick you up and get your question to us. Again, that's 646-721-9887. And tonight we've got kind of a special show, a little bit different. It's not exactly politics, but it is politics in some ways. We're going to be talking with Jan Aho from the Pearl Buck Center here in Eugene, Oregon. And it's a really interesting situation, as there's been a series of lawsuits and changes in rules around what they call sheltered workshops and how it affects this particular agency that deals with developmentally disabled folks. So I'm going to bring Jan in here and welcome her to the show. So Jan, are you there?
I am here.
And you have somebody with you also from Pearl Buck. Can you introduce her?
Yes, I have Holly Powell here.
Hello.
And Holly is our Director of Community Services, which include employment and supported living.
Great. So I guess we ought to start off for those that aren't familiar, because we've had people listening as far away as Missouri the last couple weeks. What is Pearl Buck Center?
Well, it's a comprehensive program that serves a wide range of individuals who have developmental disabilities. I think the best way to describe it is to say that we have four different programs that are serving from children whose parents have disabilities. We have a preschool. We have a sheltered workshop that serves over 150 adults that provide employment for them. And then we have day services that serves between 50 and 60 individuals that are activities, more recreational community involvement. And then we have our community-based services, which include employment, of serving close to 50 people in jobs in the community, as well as supporting individuals who are living independently but need a little extra support so that they can do that safely. And there's about 30 to 40 people in that program.
Correct.
So does that give you in a nutshell, kind of what we are? Mainly it's providing all kinds of choices, so that an individual who comes in has a range of choices where they can go to fulfill whatever their goals are. And so that's how we do it. And we've been in the community since the early 50s. And I can give you a little background if you're interested.
Yeah, I'm kind of interested, where's the name come from?
Yeah, our founder, Liesl Wechter, was an immigrant from Germany. When she came here in the very early 50s, she was leaving Germany, had left Germany in the kind of middle 40s, I think. She was a special education teacher there. And when Hitler came to power, it became unsafe for individuals with disabilities, and obviously everybody knows about people who had Jewish family members. She actually had her students taken from her. Not many people know that. And so that was a very life-changing event for her. and forced her to leave Germany. She ended up at the university or in Eugene because her husband, who also fled, got a job at the university in the architecture department. When she got here, she interviewed at the different schools trying to find a job where she could teach special ed. In the 1950s, hard to believe, we did not have any special education programs. So being the person that she was and how passionately she believed that every child has the right to learn, including kids with intellectual and developmental disabilities, she started a program in her home. And word went out very quickly. She started with 5 students, and before she knew it, she was leasing classroom space in a local church, and then had land donated and the building, a building built that grew. But because she had come from another country, she wanted to name the school after somebody who was famous. And in the 50s, Pearl Buck had written many books, most of them around China. But she also wrote a little article in a magazine called The Child Who Never Grew. And it was her personal story of being a parent of a child who had developed very profound developmental delays due to the fact that she was a PKU baby. And I'm not going to try to say the long word that that represents, but it's an enzyme that destroys the brain. The baby was born normally, but then declined very rapidly over the years. And for Pearl Buck, that was a very, very hard journey for her to come to acceptance of who her daughter was and who she became. So our founder, Lisa Wechter, wrote her when she read the article and told her she was starting this school and she wanted to name it after somebody who was famous. Pearl Buck happened to have been the first woman to win a Nobel Prize as well as a Pulitzer Prize for literature. And so it was pretty noteworthy. So Pearl Buck wrote back and said, "I don't know why anybody would want to name a school Pearl Buck, but these children have a special place in my heart. So please do that." So that's how we got the name. And I have to say, over the years, a lot of discussion, it loops around. Should we change our name? Because it doesn't describe anything about what we do. But because of that history, everybody involved with the organization has been reluctant to change our name. So we are the Pearl Buck Center.
Fascinating. And an interesting story. And you know, it's interesting because I read a book recently that focused on the issues in Germany during Hitler's reign with disabled children and all that. It was kind of an eye opener to me. Everybody hears about the Holocaust and what he did with gypsies and people of the Jewish faith, but no one really hears what he did with disabled children was just just as bad. And
it was horrific.
It was terrible. And I didn't realize that your founder actually came from that background and had left right. Germany. So that's I learned something new. I knew the connection with Pearl Buck and her daughter, but I didn't mm-hmm. know. I didn't know the Nazi Lisa, Germany connection
yeah.
there.
Right. And so, for me, what was interesting too, Jay, was that the United States, we often think of ourselves as so advanced. You know, we're doing everything on the cutting edge. And that in that area of educating and educating children with special needs, we were far behind. So she was coming from a country in the 40s that had special education classes, and we didn't have those classes until the mid-70s, 1974. So it's just interesting.
I grew up in the suburbs of Washington, D.C. in Montgomery County, Maryland. and in a very avant-garde school district, and they had a special ed school near in my neighborhood in the 60s, and this was probably 1965, and it was an exception that this school district had an actual school, but it was a segregated school for special ed, which was kind of, that was the model at the time versus where they now kind of more integrate it with the normal classrooms where they can.
Right.
So you know, even in the 60s, it was brand new. Here she was at special ed back in the 40s in Germany. So, yeah, we weren't always the leader in everything. That's been and sometimes we still aren't either. Yeah, but it's one of those things we like to believe we are.
right. So when I think about where we started as the school in the 50s, and then in the 60s, one of the things that happened, because the students that came into the program were all ages when they entered the program. And in the 60s, they were becoming young adults and were no longer really interested in school, but were more interested in work. And so she started what they called the Work Activity Center at that time. And it was, you know, at that time, there were no copy machines that collated. There were no machines that put labels on. And so they were doing that kind of work for little businesses and big businesses in our community. And that was kind of some of the beginning works of what became now our, I would say, pretty sophisticated sheltered workshop, began out of that work activity center in the 60s. So they were doing some packaging, small packaging of things, but very, very, very simple things in the 60s. In the 70s, and it was at the same time that mainstreaming was starting, and some of the students in the school were given the opportunity to mainstream into their home district. So we started having empty classes because students started, you know, going into their community schools, which was great for those students. And the United Way did a needs assessment in conjunction with University of Oregon and discovered that there were some individuals who had some cognitive challenges who were parenting their kids. Now, know that this is in the very early 70s or mid-70s. And at that time, there were no brain scans that were being done that happened, you know, later in the 80s and the 90s. But this community was concerned, and the leadership at United Way was concerned, that there were individuals who were parenting children who had cognitive challenges. The parents had the challenges, not the kids. And they were concerned that the kids' brains would not develop because they wouldn't get the appropriate stimulation that they needed for their brains to develop. I was the director of the preschool for many years, and one of the things that I didn't learn until later that was very interesting to me is when a baby is born, unlike the heart, which comes and starts beating, and the lungs that start breathing, and the kidneys start doing their thing, and the liver starts doing their thing, and the stomach does its thing, and the bowels definitely do their thing with the baby. The brain is waiting for stimulation from its environment for it to, what I would simply put, wake up. So we've heard about the Romanian orphans in the 80s, where they were not touched, they were not held, they were not talked to, and those babies became profoundly delayed. And it wasn't that they were born that way. It was that they were not given a chance for their brains to fully develop because they did not get the stimulation. And the stimulation is simple. It's a touch. It's a sound. It's a smell. It's all, and the singing, all those little things are things that make a brain wake up. And without that, frankly, the babies' brains don't develop, young children's brains don't develop. That was a new concept for me. I honestly thought that the brain that I was born with was what it is today. But it was just kind of like a sponge waiting for the world around me to stimulate it. And so the United Way folks, they said, we need to start a preschool for those kids so that they have a chance to get the stimulation that the parents may not be able to give them, because we want to make sure those kids can enter school ready to learn. I think the community needs to be really, really proud of that, because there is no other preschool like this in the United States that is specifically designed to serve these children and their parents at no cost to the family.
Wow.
It's a cost to us, but it's a cost to the family. So that happened in the 70s, and that was pretty, it was a wonderful opportunity for us because we had classroom space here at Pearl Buck Center. And it was something that has continued to go and serve those families all these years. So that was in the 70s. In the 80s, the state did some incentivizing, which we'll get to circle back around, for community employment. And so it was perfect for us because we were interested in that. And so we began a little more robust community employment, taking individuals that were in the work activity center, sheltered workshop, into a more community-based employment. So that was in the 80s. And then in the 90s, Fairview closed. That was significant. And it was driven by some of the same things that are driving the sheltered workshop issue today, which was getting people out of a segregated, non-integrated environment and bringing them back into the community. And so when that was happening, we were contacted by the state, because we did have space at our building that was on West Amazon at the time for individuals to come for a day program. And when it started, we only had 12 people in that program, and they were people who had been living at Fairview State Hospital and then were being integrated back into the community. And so that was what we call our Life Enhancing Activities Program today. The LEAP program. So that program started in the 90s. And in the 2000s, we were busting out of our building, both of the buildings, the building up on West Amazon. And what I forgot to say was that in the 60s, we built a building on West Fifth for our sheltered workshop and our what we called our production center. And so we've located a building here on West Fifth, on West First, I'm sorry, between Bertelson and Seneca, and that was large enough at 50,000 square feet for us to be able to move all programs onto one site. And so we started a capital campaign and moved into the building and integrated all programs onto one site. So we've been here since 2008 was when the preschool joined the adult services that moved in first in that during the winter of 2007. And so we've been in our new building since then, and we are now busting out of our seams at our new building. So the services and the need for the services, which is very interesting, at all levels and in every program, have not decreased. They've increased. And I think one of the things that, I don't know if I want to get into this right now, but is driving all of the kinds of things that we're dealing around funding and funding of these kinds of services is that I think people imagine that with technology and everything that we'd have fewer children with disabilities being born. And it's quite the opposite. With all of our technology, babies that used to never survive are surviving, and some of them are surviving with significant needs. And the cost that that is putting on to our Medicaid system is great. And our programs for our adults and for young children who have disabilities are funded through that program. So, and that kind of gives, yeah, just kind of putting that out there.
Yeah, well, pretty interesting. You know, it is kind of interesting. You know, I have a friend, Bob Bergman, who's developmentally disabled. And not too long ago, 10 or 15 years ago, you were talking about how back in the 70s they were collating documents because there weren't machines that did it
right then.
Mm-hmm. I think about 15 years ago, he was putting records on microfilm as something that he could do. And at the time, I was working for Eugene Water and Electric Board, and he used to do the microfilming of their payroll records. So
wow.
He used to joke with me that he was gonna mess up my paychecks if I wasn't nice to him.
You were nice to him.
Yeah, he's a funny guy. He remembers interesting facts, and he remembers that I went to the University of Maryland, who is the Terrapins, and they shortened that into Terps, which, you know, T-E-R-P-S. And every time I see Bob and he hears my voice, he goes, "Hey, Jay, how you doing, you old terp?" And people overhear that and don't realize he's saying terp with a P, not with a D.
You bet you're maybe sorry that you said that on the radio.
yeah, it's true. Yeah, but yeah, what a fun and happy personality he is, and just love being around him. He's a great guy. But you know, again, you know, it's kind of interesting. You know, technology changes. Nobody puts stuff on microfiche anymore.
It's
all stored in the cloud.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
So, I know. So, isn't that a frightening thought?
Yeah. Yeah.
Where's that cloud?
Yeah.
You know, I have recently learned it's a chicken ranch, you know, out in Central Oregon, you know, but anyway, it's not up in the sky like I thought it was. Anyway.
No, it's a server ranch somewhere. Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
So it sounds like you actually grew from inside the organization. You weren't an outside hire as executive director. Is that an accurate statement?
Yeah, I was the director of the preschool for, I think it was 16 years, when the person who was the executive director at that time was leaving, and the board asked me if I would step in as interim, partly because I was one of the senior staff, and I had been here longer than anybody else had been here. And so I had a good sense of the, history of the organization and that. So I did step in, and in the process, I had decided that with the urging of two of the other senior staff that I would be interested in applying for the position. And so I did actively go after it, and it was a competitive process. It was a challenging experience for me. I felt like I grew a lot just going through the process, and I was really honored when the board offered me that position. And I think it's 6 years ago that I was offered that position and accepted that. And came up through, you know, through the preschool, had a little bit of experience in adult services. When I was initially hired, I was overseeing what we called the LEAP program, the day activities program, for the adults as well as the preschool. But I had a lot of learning to do. And one of the things that I have found, and I think anybody else that's in a position such as mine, is that you really have to keep looking for people that are around you who are smarter than you are and who know things about different things that you don't know. And I've been very lucky to have a senior staff that is like that, that they know their programs, they know them well, and I can rely on them to, you know, follow through on what they need to, find out what they need to if they don't already know it. And so, yeah, it's been a great experience for me.
Yeah. So let's see, I was counting. That was 16 years as the preschool director. And then there's probably a little bit of interim in there. And then at least 6 years executive director. So I'm counting about 23 years with Pearl Buck.
Something like that. Pretty close to that. I was doing both jobs for six months. And when I was hired, somebody said to me, "Oh my gosh, it must be so hard for you to leave the preschool because you've been doing that, you know, for so long. This must be such a difficult transition." And I said, "I cannot tell you what a relief it is to have the new director in place and for the preschool, so I can just focus on one job." So it was a happy time, actually, to be able to move into that position, with that being my sole focus.
So it means you go back and have 26 years of experience of working with folks that have intellectual and developmentally disabilities, and probably
what I will say is, kind of my background before I came here was my degree and my education was in speech pathology and general education. But at that time, I was able to get a dual credential. And then I taught I was a teacher of special ed kids. And so my whole career has been in special ed. My very first internship as a speech pathologist was with kids who had orthopedic disabilities, spina bifida, cerebral palsy, and all kinds of different things. And that experience changed my life. I knew I would never be a speech therapist in a public school setting working with what I would call regular kids. I really enjoyed the special population. It was something that I just liked and I felt really comfortable in. And so I was a special day class teacher for a number of years. And then I was a speech pathologist in a program serving kids with special needs. And then I moved up here and worked with survivors of traumatic brain injury that were adults before I became director of the preschool. So when I got the job in the preschool, I felt like I was bringing everything I had ever done in the past to what I was going to get a chance to do next. And so it's been you look at it and you go, yeah, that's how you got here. And you never would have thought that's what you were going to do when I first started school. But it's been a good journey. I've enjoyed it.
It sounds like it. And you know, you always wonder how you end up in what you're doing. I often wonder how I ended up a county commissioner from being a civil engineer. Which is a whole nother show.
And, it's interesting. I want to give Holly a chance to say how she ended up here, because I think her story is interesting, too, because you never know. So I'm putting her on the spot because I want her to say what happened to her when she came and interviewed her here.
Okay. She is putting me on the spot just a little bit. I moved to Oregon about 10 years ago from the Midwest. And was a stay-at-home mom for a few years once we moved here. And it was time for me to start looking for part-time work, and there was a position at the Pearl Buck Center, which I had never heard of. And for whatever reason in my life, had never been around anybody with disabilities. Excuse me. For whatever reason, I don't know why that is, but it's how my life was. I had owned businesses in the past and came here and interviewed, and they did a tour. And I call it my first Eugene moment, because you got to remember, I'm a Midwest girl, and was supposed to be here for whatever reason. And 8 years later, here I am. I was part-time admin assistant, excuse me, and started out doing that for about a year. And then typical nonprofit, you if you're willing to do some work, they will give it to you. And 8 years later, now I'm the director of community services. And so when I interview people and they're concerned about not having any experience working with people with disabilities, I reassure them that you don't need the experience. You either have it or you don't. And this is a place that you either want to be or you don't. And when people come and walk in our doors, it's life-changing, I think, for people. So that's my story.
I've toured the facilities several times over the years, and every time I tour it, it's a great experience. And I know what you mean when you walk through the doors. You either know you want to be there or not. So I'd like to, you know, now between the two of you, there's years and years of experience. But particularly, Jan, you've kind of been around long enough and have described the history of how we've moved from, the original schools that were, that were set up to where they went to mainstreaming of students with the student population, but then that opened up the ability to have the adult workshop, the sheltered workshop there, and also, the ability to have the preschool for children of people with disabilities. Mm-hmm. And now there's some changes coming that are part of kind of almost a national movement, but also in settlement of some legal actions. And first, if you could kind of describe for our listeners what it constitutes a closed or sheltered workshop, and if you could kind of describe that for folks, because the changes are particularly around that issue.
Right. Okay, a sheltered workshop, I think in the eyes of the state, they've kind of eliminated this number, but earlier last year, I guess, they were saying anytime you have 8 or more people with a disability together doing anything, they didn't really care what it was, living together, working together, playing together, whatever they were doing, that is a sheltered workshop. It's congregating people together with disabilities that is segregating them from the rest of the community. So I don't know. I'm looking at Holly saying, does that best describe it? I think
it does. That's how the state.
That's how the state would describe it. They're kind of changing on that number thing, they're kind of being more vague in that, but it is whenever you congregate people under a roof, that is a sheltered workshop, and they are doing work. Now, one of the really, I don't know if it's a driving force around that. I think there's two things that have happened. One is the cost of services have gone up. There is no doubt about that across the nation and from the federal government, which is kind of where those monies eventually come into our door. They start there, they come through the state, and then they come to us to purchase services that we provide for the individuals. Clearly, all of us who have ever worked in this field want individuals to be a part of the community as much as they choose to be a part of the community and is appropriate for the individual, and that the person feels it's an appropriate thing. So the rub comes is that what happened on July 1st of last year was that pressure from the state, from the lawsuit, and I'll wrap back around to that in a moment, the front door to the sheltered workshop was closed for any individual who would like to enter it after July 1st, particularly any of the students that are in high school who would have been coming out of programs who may wanted to use this as a transition place to learn skills and to learn about what work is. as an avenue to employment, that was no longer possible, and it is no longer possible. So our front door is closed, and the state has made that abundantly clear. So it's closed. So we cannot enroll any more individuals into the program. What they are saying is that as of July, I think it's July 2019, is when they say they will no longer fund anybody that is in a sheltered workshop. So we're in 2016. So between now and 2019, our job is to assess which of our clients are wanting to work in the community and really put every effort we have into finding jobs for those individuals and really helping them to do that. Our big challenge, there's two big challenges in that, is that we have over 150 people right now who are in our sheltered workshop. When this was happening, as in last May and June, like in April of last year, I think we had like 120 individuals. That's pretty close. But within the last 2-3 months before those doors closed, programs in our area closed their sheltered workshops and asked us to take those individuals into our program. And so we did. So our numbers ballooned to the point of having 150 people. So I want to clarify, that's not 150 people every single day. Some people come 3 days a week, some come five, some come two, some come in the morning, some come in the afternoon. So it's very different. But it is serving 150 people in the sheltered workshop. So our challenge is to find jobs, and those jobs have to be community jobs, and they have to be competitive employment. So they need to make at least minimum wage. And we will provide support. We will provide a job coach and support for that individual. But we need businesses who are interested in working with us to help match the skills that our individuals have and the interest that they have to work in certain places and to find employers who want to partner with us. And we've had one example that I'll use that was pretty heartwarming to me anyway, was Togo's. John Anderson came and visited early last year. And he walked in, and we had talked, and he was coming in, and I thought he was going to talk to me about making a significant donation to the organization, right? And he said, well, really what I want to talk about is I've started these new stores, and I want to employ some of your people. Are you interested? And needless to say, I said, oh, yeah. We are very interested. So I hooked him up with Lori Polk, one of our job developers, and they talked. And he subsequently has hired three individuals in his stores. And then one day I'm coming to work, and this LTD bus drives by, and plastered across the whole side of the bus is Togo's hires Pearl Buck Center people to work in their, you know, store, something like that. I can't remember. You can look at it somewhere. I know those buses are around. But it was wonderful. You know, they were proud. And I said, John, thank you so much. And he said, no, thank you. This is good business. And so we need lots of people like that in our community if we're going to be able to find work for people so that they can fulfill what their dreams are for community employment. The challenge in that, though, is we have other individuals who, at this point anyway, are saying they don't want to work in the community. And our board, and myself included, are very committed to being able to provide work for them in a sheltered workshop setting as long as they want that. Funding could become an issue for that, but frankly, we are doing very well in our production work, and we have incredible business partners that give us lots of meaningful work for our people, so that I'm confident we'll be able to survive this next phase in ProBuck Center's career and life as it is. It keeps evolving. It'll continue to evolve. The other thing is that we are looking at we've got this wonderful facility. We've got wonderful things that are here for people to work on. And we have people who really know how to help people get ready for work. And so we are looking at, and this is not widespread, so hopefully there's not a lot of people listening, but we are looking at really developing a vocational academy that would provide an opportunity for individuals to come here who are interested in work and want to work and want to learn skills. It could be as simple as I want to be able to learn how to drive a forklift and be certified to do that so that I can get a job, you know, working at Weyerhaeuser or Bi-Mart. And so we are exploring this with the state. It's going to be a long process. But we are really looking seriously and have begun conversations with the state of how that might look and where funding might come for that. But it would open the door again to the young students coming out of high school.
Interesting. Yeah. It leads me to a little bit of a question, though. Had close contact, like with Bob Bergman, who is fairly high functioning, although he's wheelchair confined and blind, so he also has other issues to deal with at the same time. So it's difficult for him to be in an open workplace without assistance. And then I have a stepbrother who was a high functioning developmentally disabled person. He even had a driver's license and drove. But even he was able to be in an unsheltered workplace, but ultimately became a victim of a sexual predator. So it was rather disheartening that you can't, it's very difficult sometimes that these personalities can be almost defenseless to that sort of person.
Absolutely.
At times. So it's really, really sickening, disheartening. There are people that will take advantage of those folks. But there's a kind of a not quite the day folks that are there for stimulation and other activities that come to your day center.
Right.
But there's not always folks that have the ability to function in a workplace and may not even be able to express whether their desire to not be in a closed workshop or to be in an open workplace, there's always going to be that lower functioning group of folks.
Yeah.
How's the state dealing with that? Is they're making any exception for those folks that almost have to have a sheltered workshop, and it makes them at least feel more useful than, say, a day activity center, where they're not doing really something useful where they feel like they have a job. It's amazing how much those folks that are kind of in the lower end of the functionality are proud that they have a job. Even if it's just collating papers or whatever it is that's very simple.
Right.
I've toured your facilities and I've met some of them, and it's just, is there anything in this whole discussion around trying to mainstream and get rid of shelter workshops, that there is a population that maybe that's actually what serves them best?
Currently, there is not. The state feels it's an employment first movement, that everyone should be working, regardless of the disability. And it is an agency like ours job to assist that person regardless of the job. So if it's someone that, again, is maybe nonverbal, needs assistance toileting, they still feel that there is a job in the community for them. And it would be up to this provider agency like ours to support that person while they're at that job. I think one of the issues we're going to find is that it's very costly. These are people that are going to need one-on-one support at all times. Mm-hmm. It's a challenge. I, as the community director, am passionate about employment in the community. And I feel if someone wants a job in the community, it's our job to find one, regardless of their disability. But I also feel that we have a place here that is a safe environment, and it's a choice. And they can come here, like you said, and have value. And so it's challenging. It's but that's the state's position at this point. And there are, unfortunately, if it continues as it is, there will be folks that will not, according to the state, possibly not have a place like ours to go to, and probably sit at home, honestly. And that's very sad. And I think there needs to be continued to be looked at.
Yeah, because the interaction is so important to those folks.
I mean, this is their community. As you've been here, this is where their friends are. This is where they feel safe. And, you know, we have ourselves have rights to go to work and have our friends when we can choose where we want to go. And they should have that same right.
So I think you summed up kind of the dilemma that we find ourselves in that Holly described so well, which is that when you talked about the individual with that was, victim of a sexual predator, for many of our folks, not many, but yes, many, frankly, their ability and their desire for friendship is very strong, and they make themselves vulnerable to people who are not interested in the person's safety and best interests. So it's a dilemma for us, and it's a challenge for family members when we have many of our parents absolutely will not allow their son or daughter to work in the community for precisely that reason. And one of our board members said, so my daughter has 12 to 13 different kinds of seizures. She needs somebody to change her when she soils herself, and she needs to be fed. So are we really going to ask one of her coworkers to do that? Because ultimately that is what the state wants. We will provide a job coach, but in many cases they want us eventually to get what they call natural supports, so the people they work with. Well, the fact is, that's a really tough ask for any business. And we're a business too. And so I understand what that would mean to a business. And so it's putting, there's a lot of pressures on this. And then I want to go about what you said, Jay, that I really appreciated about work and work being meaningful, is that one of the phrases that has come out of the state that has been so hard for me to swallow is we want people to have meaningful work. And what many people don't realize is the work that the people are doing here is meaningful to that individual. And it's very disrespectful for somebody to demean that and to demean that value that that individual feels about a job well done. So you hit it on the head, and that's exactly where we find ourselves today.
Yeah, so that's a real dilemma. And to add to that, the fact that you can no longer take kids that are matriculating out of high school and bring them into at least the shelter workshop long enough for them to get the skills to be able to deal with an unsheltered workplace.
Right.
Hopefully you guys will eventually convince the state that your program there to give people work skills will qualify, and they'll reopen the front door to at least that training program.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's kind of renaming rebranding some of what you do, but it still doesn't change the fact that there's going to be people graduating out of the school system that are going to fit that lower level of functionality set that would be better off possibly in a sheltered workplace than they would be out in the public. And there's even some high functioning folks that actually would prefer the sheltered, you know, that will actually tell you, I like it here better than I like it. You know, I've done both. You know, some of them have actually had the opportunity to do both, and they would much rather be in your sheltered workshop around, you know, folks that they identify with as their peers.
Right.
Yeah.
We actually have some individuals here that I would consider higher functioning. We've actually got them jobs in the community. One gentleman, we've got him three jobs in the community over the years, and he quits every one of them to come back. And for multiple reasons. So this is their place they want to be.
One of the individuals, I love something he told his sister. I really like it at Probuck Center because I don't have to pretend to be normal.
Yeah.
I mean, that sums it up. I mean, for all of us, you know, but I mean, that really, it kind of says a lot in that statement.
Yeah, for somebody in that emotional, developmental state, that is truly comforting to be able to be yourself.
Yeah.
And when you force them, you know, that square peg into the round hole, they're not comfortable. So I can see where you would get a statement like that out of somebody where, I really like being here because I can be myself. that's really cute and fun. So it's an interesting issue. And I understand the motivations behind some of it. You know, it's the same thing with mental health issues. Everybody gets the picture of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest and Nurse Ratched. You know, and we all knew that was wrong, but completely, you know, I think we finally realized that, you know, with our homeless population being over 50% having a mental health issue, we've realized we may have gone too far. That there's some of those people that actually might function better in an institutionalized situation of some degree. It's just a matter of finding the happy medium. There is a need maybe for that sheltered workshop, and there's also the need for folks like John Anderson's that will employ people.
I was going to say something that was interesting that you said about mental illness is that, and the homeless people, is that also a lot of homeless people are also people who do have some cognitive issues, and many of them have not been identified and dealt with early on in their lives because they just were not. And many of the individuals that we have, a very high percentage, have dual diagnosis. It is not just a cognitive issue. It isn't just an individual with Down syndrome. It is an individual that may have schizophrenia as well as severe cognitive issues. You know what I mean? And so we're dealing with people with very complex health issues and cognitive issues and mental health issues. It's not it's not simple, the people that we're dealing with. And I'm thinking of a young woman who had a job, has had several jobs in the community, and very verbal, very independent, you know, can fight for her own rights and everything else. But she is so fragile that if you suggest that maybe she didn't do the thing quite right, you could lose her for 3 days. She'd be gone. She's out of the building. I'm not coming back. I made a mistake. So every job she had, when somebody said, well, could you do it this way? Simple, nice, everything else said as nicely as possible. But her self-esteem is so fragile that she could not take that in any job. And even here, with staff who are trained and aware and all of that, that kind of feedback is devastating. So when it's not a simple issue, I guess that's what I'm saying. This is not simple. And so just as the lawsuit that was filed against the state for people who felt that individuals were being unfairly kept in sheltered workshops who wanted community employment, I think the writing is on the wall that there could be a lawsuit for individuals who feel they are being forced to have jobs in the community and they want to work in a sheltered setting because that's where they feel safe and that's where they feel successful. So I think the potential is there. I'm not up for it, but I think there may be other individuals who are.
Yeah, so that kind of brings me to, you know, we only got about three or four minutes left here. What can the public do, you know, to help you out? Is it a matter of maybe lobbying their state representatives and making them understand the situation better? Who can they be talking to about this? If they've been listening to the program, they kind of understand the problem now and they want to kind of, how can they help?
I think the advocacy is a big piece. We have our delegation here from Lane County that serves our area anyway, are very, very, very supportive of Pearl Buck Center. We're very fortunate that way. But that view is not shared throughout the legislature. And frankly, Jay, a lot of it is driven by money. The state knows unless we do close sheltered workshops, Medicaid won't fund it. They won't pay for the service. So the only alternative is then for the state to say, and I think one state did it. I thought it was Maryland. You could check on that. But one state did say, okay, you won't, federal government, you won't pay for it. We value this service. We will pay for it. But that is a hard one to sell anybody.
Yeah.
You know what the resources and revenue is right now just for the county. Magnify that for the state. So it's very, very complicated. But advocacy that more and more people, yes, any of that to people that they know who are in a position to impact, yes, that kind of thing is important. For people who own businesses, consider, you have no idea what a change it would make for the culture in your organization to have an individual with a disability working there.
It just starts with one person.
Yeah.
Just one individual that's hired, and then they're talking to other businesses because they're going to have some amazing people working for them. And that is also a big key to helping us and helping the individuals we serve.
Great.
And
well, hopefully a lot of businesses will hear the program.
Yeah. And I encourage people who are interested to actually see firsthand to just connect with us and come and see. And then we can talk further about how you can support.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Jan and Holly, for being on the show tonight. It was very educational. And hopefully things will.
It was a pleasure, Jay.
No, I appreciate it. Hopefully things will work out well for you guys in the future. and folks will talk to their legislators. But most of all, they should get a hold of you, because I think touring your facilities is truly eye-opening. So thank you,
Jay.
And that's it for the Bozo Show tonight.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.